For most of us, if we are very lucky, history will not really remember us. Why would that be lucky? Well, when you think about it, most humans only enter the records of history due to negative reasons. You're either the victim of a disaster, or the victim of a crime, or maybe you were foolish enough to commit a crime. The census records will preserve us for posterity in most countries, but in truth, the blessed anonymity of the mass of human beings is a fate preserved for many of us. As it always has been, so it always shall be. That fact, however, does make the job of a historian a tad more difficult. London is a city, so it is filled with people, and it is, as I've often said, the people who make London. And in most of the episodes so far, due to time and pressures of the ongoing narrative, we rarely get a chance to look at the normal people. Just look at their lives. So that is what this chapter of the story of London does, at least part of it. It stops the grand narrative and looks at the names and stories from the 1330s. Consider it a snapshot into the lives of Londoners during the decade before the Black Death. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is my podcast, The Story of London. This is me trying to tell the entire history of London as a single narrative tale, breaking up the long and detailed events of the city into smaller, more manageable chunks. And this issue is part of that process. It will refer to ongoing issues across England and in Europe, refer to wars and conflicts and economic crisis as the reign of Edward III really gets going, but I won't be explaining them in any detail. Rather, this is a remembrance of a city that no longer exists, London in the third decade of the 14th century. Where possible, I will use their own words, and the intention is to rattle along at a fair old pace, never staying for too long on any one person or subject, but sweeping over the city and picking out people and their tales. Some tragic, some shocking, some funny, some sad. And it also tells the story of a full-blown punch-up and riot that took place between a brand new mayor and a bunch of angry fishmongers packing knives. Welcome then to chapter 119 of The Story of London, The Battle of Bridge Street. To be a male Londoner in this decade meant that you were a man who could be sent to war. Last chapter I mentioned how about 500 Londoners had marched with King Edward and Roger Mortimer up to Scotland to join in the fighting there, and I explained what happened to Edward's force when they got there. Those 500 Londoners were not the only contribution London made to that particular war effort. For example, there was a team of 63 tent makers who were working up in Holborn on fabricating the giant tent used by the young King Edward. This tent was massive. It was basically a great hall with six posts and a chamber for the prince himself. And they also constructed another 26 tents, presumably for the Londoners. Edward III's principal tent maker, whose job description was the marvellously titled Pavilion on Arras, was from 1331 all through this decade a man called John de Yakesley, a Londoner who ended up having an impressive mansion on Cornhill. War was profitable, and war was profitable because war was bloody expensive. And we have a lovely insight during the 1330s about just how expensive it could be and how elaborate London's preparations had to be to facilitate their part in a war. In 1334, for example, when another group of Londoners were required to join the armed forces fighting in Scotland, we see the city to have to suddenly raise money for, quote, Edmund Flambard, the leader of the same men, and for gowns, lances, and standards, and the wage of a minstrel, unquote. Yeah, you didn't actually have an army you could join. If any armed forces were being sent off, they had to raise, supply, equip and pay for the armed forces themselves. And then joining a medieval army wasn't just cut and dried. you'd have to pass selection, and this was actually quite tough. Quote, after this, the men were selected by Edmund Flambard, Simon de Stapleford and John Amos, and then they were again chosen and surveyed by the mayor and the aldermen, whereupon each man-at-arms received 10 marks and his gowns, the same being for himself and his groom and his horse, for the going to the king and returning and staying 40 days after coming to him. Unquote. So recruitment was not just a simple thing. Literally, if you wanted a job to join the armed forces, you had to go through a two-stage interview. You had to be approved not just by the commander of this force, in this case the man Flambard, but also by the civic authorities. The first probably to see if you could fight, and the second to see if you were the kind of person who'd been in trouble and shouldn't really be given weapons. And while it's supposedly just to get 100 men going to Scotland, notice the wording, 100 men plus a groom. So we're now at 200 men and each of them has a horse, plus an additional 100 men without a groom going on foot. So it's 300 men, all provisioned and equipped to serve the king. And they did indeed march to Scotland, and included in the ranks were men with names like John Go in the Wind, who sounds like just the kind of man you want on that kind of escapade. However, those hundreds of men going off to fight in Scotland led to a rather unfortunate incident down on Bridgeward, near Fenchurch Street. See, when the mayor at the time, Sebastian Conduit, was organising these men, during the discussions the mayor raised the point, no doubt based on knowing how London worked and what kind of people lived in the city. Quote, inquisition was made by the mayor, how and in what manner the rebels and opponents of said assignment ought to be punished and distrained, unquote. So, basically, the mayor knew there would be some folks in London who would be all saying, I'm not bloody well paying taxes for a couple of hundred guys to piss off to fight in Scotland. So he's asking his fellow London organisers, what should we do about these people? The mayor was being very smart here. He knows somebody is going to be an arse about the sudden new tax needed to pay for John Go in the Wind and his mates to march off to Scotland, and so he's seeking all the aldermen and those present to say how he should act, so therefore he can't be accused of being a tyrant. The reply he got? Quote, to which the aldermen and commonalty aforesaid made answer, by distress, sequestrations, and all of the means of coercion whatsoever, seeing that the business stood in need of such great haste, unquote. So as well as sending off the 300 men to go fight in Scotland, London's authorities were also saying, look, if anybody objects, just fine them or close down their business or do whatever to shut them the hell up. This is just a crisis. We just don't have time to deal with that, okay? And that response is what led to our incident over in Bridgeward. See, down by the river, there lived a man called William de Morden, and he was a fishmonger. He also had a nice little shop and made a decent living, which was unfortunately for him assessed to be rich enough to afford the tax of 1 mark of silver needed to pay for this armed force to piss off to Scotland. And one of the sheriffs of London, a man called William Turk, went down to collect it, alongside one of his sergeants, a man called John DeRay, and a bunch of others. But when they told this fishmonger about the money he had to cough up, quote, whereupon he, the same William, refused to pay such monies. Wherefore, the same John DeRay, sergeant of our Lord the King, as aforesaid, sequestered the goods of the same William in his shop there being, and shut the doors and windows of the shop, and according to the custom of the city, in like manner sequestered them under his seal, unquote. So, yeah, when the authorities turned up and asked for 1 mark of silver, William went no way in paying that, and as mandated, his shop was closed and it would remain sealed until he paid the mark of silver. Quote, whereupon, the same William forthwith, by violence, opened his shop and broke the said sequestration and exposed for sale the goods so sequestered and removed the same, in contempt of our Lord the King, to the amount of 100 marks, unquote. So yeah, he broke the seals and just opened up his business again. Which got him into a lot of trouble, and when brought before the mayor, quote, he could not deny the matters aforesaid. Therefore, it was ordered that he should go to prison, etc., until he should have made fine to our Lord the King for such contempt, unquote. But William's issues did not end there, because, quote, immediately hereupon, the said mayor and aldermen and sheriffs we're given to understand that said William de Morden, on the Saturday after the feast of St. Andrew the Apostle, said before many trustworthy persons in the city that instead of paying said assessment, he was sure of 100 men, 40 of whom were ready to drag the greatest and wealthiest men of the city out of their houses and behead them without the gates thereof. Unquote. Oh, William, you and your big mouth. So you can imagine him mouthing off and venting, and he was probably not entirely lying. He's a fishmonger, and as we know, the fishmongers were a rather radical and ever so slightly psychotically violent bunch of traders on the streets of the city. They did go around in large groups, and they were heavily armed, and when he said he knew 100 blokes who would stand by him, he may well not have been lying. And when he said he knew 40 blokes who may be willing to go chop the heads of the mayor, he also could have been telling the truth. But in the 1330s, mouthing off and venting like that could get you into a hell of a lot of trouble. Quote, as to which the same William, being there questioned about how he should acquit himself, said he was not guilty thereof, unquote. The rather inept shopkeeper, however, was retained in jail as a trial was held, after him saying stuff like that, and, quote, thereupon the said William de Morden acknowledged that he had said the things before stated as imputed to him, and put himself upon the favour of the mayor and the alderman, therefore as a judge that he should go to prison, unquote. Yep, Big Mouth Fishmonger had managed to talk himself back into jail for the secondary offence of threatening the mayor. It's sometimes easy to think that all London ever did was punish folks. And yes, records of crime are one of our primary documents, and I will be coming back to crime in a bit. But not everything brought before the mayor was bad. Consider the case of Lawrence de Long, a rich brewer over in Ludgate, who died suddenly and his estate came into possession of his young son Richard. Richard was too young to own his father's inheritance, and it was quite a lot. Quote, the said Richard has one brew house and three shops in the parish of St. Martin, Ludgate in London, which are worth yearly in all the issues thereof, £4, 11 shillings and 8 pence, from which will be to deducted quit rent due yearly to the Church of St. Paul in London, 22 shillings and 6 pence, and quit rent due yearly to the Abbot of Westminster of 13 shillings, and also for reprise on the house and shops aforesaid yearly, 16 shillings, unquote. Reprise was basically rent charges. And after paying rent to St. Paul Cathedral and Westminster Abbey, this meant that after all these overheads, the father's estate had a, quote, clear yearly value of the said house and shops is 40 shillings and 2 pence, unquote. Young Richard de Long had also inherited his father's brewing equipment, expensive specialist items ranging from the tubs used for brewing, each costing 2 pence, to a tap tray and the mash vats, each worth 18 pence. The city authorities made a careful inventory of all the goods the late Lawrence left his son. And then the mayor and the alderman granted all these items and property to one, quote, Simon Mars, goldsmith, to hold the same for the benefit of the aforesaid Richard until his lawful age, unquote. And they placed some really heavy threats upon the goldsmith to make sure he would see it through. Sometimes they just did the decent thing. This was a city that was basically focused on trying to function peacefully, smoothly. And you see this in the laws they passed. Back in chapter 102, the one I did about the NIMBYs of London, I pointed out that laws were passed to reflect what was going on at the time. And during the 1330s, there's some really interesting laws passed trying to make the city run smoothly. We see that in 1334, the mayor and the alderman issued decrees that, quote, no person, denizen or stranger, other than officers of the city and those who keep the peace, shall go armed or shall carry arms by day or by night within the franchise of the said city on pain of imprisonment and of losing the arms, unquote. The city was obviously trying to curtail serious crime by banning people carrying weapons. Knife crime has forever been London's bane, it seems. And to that rule, it also added that, quote, also, it is agreed that whosoever shall draw sword or knife or other arm in a fray of the people shall be forthwith attached and shall have imprisonment, unquote. So not only was carrying a weapon banned. If you even pulled a blade, let alone use it, you would go to jail. These are standard kinds of laws, you would imagine. But right in the middle of that decree is a very interesting exception. From chapter 112 onwards, I did 6 whole episodes on the rise of the livery companies and of the livery wars, and basically how the craftsmen of London, dressed in uniforms or liveries, were no more than armed gangs of workers who often sought to settle their differences via violence. And we also know that paradoxically, the city authorities depended on the liveries and the livery companies and the craftsmen who run them in order to keep the peace. And because of that, a double standard was applied to London's law. So in that same decree that banned anybody from carrying and brandishing weapons, it then specifically mentions, quote, the people of the trades to which such offenders belong, unquote. And then it says that these offenders, quote, shall make alliance or understanding as amongst them to support or to embolden such offenders, unquote. And then it mentions that, quote, men of said trade shall seek vengeance against one another under colour of such offence, unquote. So this is a law clearly responding to the livery gangs of London. But rather than now, after identifying them, threatening them with imprisonment, London's authorities clearly go the other way. And it says, quote, if they shall be able to make good accord between the parties, let them make it. And if not, let them bring the parties before the officers of the city. And before them, let them have their recovery according as law and right demand, unquote. So this is giving an exception to any armed men in a livery company. Specific rules for conflicts between the liveries was being set up. One rule for them, one rule for everyone else. But this is London, and as I said back in that previous chapter about the NIMBYs, you always see laws that come about because somebody was pissing off somebody else. And my favourite law from the 1330s was, quote, also we do forbid, on the same pain of imprisonment, that any man shall go about at this feast of Christmas with companions disguised with false faces, or in any other manner, to the house of the good folks of the city for the playing of dice there. But let each one keep himself quiet and at ease within his own house, unquote. Yeah, 1330s. There will be no Christmas parties. I just like the idea that at Christmas, travelling around in masks to bang up your neighbour's door so you can gamble a bit was what people did. This city, however, was ultimately a city of workers and of craftsmen. And while the craft guilds were not everything, there were a lot of professions in London. One source written in this period listed 111 different crafts in London that were organised and as some kind of master and apprentice system. Our problem with such lists, however, is that they often used job titles and descriptions for roles that were understood at contemporary times, and they were in use quite a lot, but their usage has faded, and what they actually did for a living becomes more confusing. So some crafts like coopers and bladesmiths have the same meaning now as they used to have then, but burlisters refer to the weavers of burl cloth, a rougher and cheaper version of wool. And burlisters were street hawkers who sold whatever they could carry upon London streets and were not to be confused with hucksters, who were street food sellers, usually carrying fish upon them. And these jobs have names that have not aged well. London then had limners, the painters who illuminated manuscripts, and galcomakers, the men who made wooden soled sandals, a profession that was absorbed by the pouch makers of London. I've never been able to understand that. And these men would rub shoulders with latteners, or men who worked with latter, a zinc copper alloy which could be used like brass, and you're going to see quite a few latter items during this episode. In London this decade then, as you walked through the streets, you would have fellmongers, the dealers in animal skins, who would sell their products to parchmeners, who would turn sheepskin into parchment, who would then sell this to bookbinders. The paternosters of London specialised in making beads, usually for rosaries, if not actually make the full-blown rosary themselves. Quilters would place raw wool between two finely made linen cloths to literally make a quilt. And they would walk the streets alongside botchers who repaired or bought and sold second-hand clothing. And all of these people would engage in chats and go to inns alongside jewellers, organ makers, barbers, mirrorers, feathermongers and seal engravers. There were people in London, of course, who didn't just do one thing. Around this time period, we meet a man called Robert Legg, and his job was an agelet maker, a man technically concerned with only making the metal tags on shoelaces, although he quickly expanded his business into making the shoelaces themselves. But then we do meet men who only ever did one thing. Two of them, Roger Haxalt and Robert J. Shillington, who in a couple of decades would admit that they had known no other craft other than being, quote, workers in wood for saddles, unquote, and who supplied materials to the fusters who made saddle bows or to the saddlers who finished and then sold the final product. And thus we end up with a city filled with wimplers, callers, camisers and cabaresters, shirt makers, paltock makers and linen armourers, the people who made the tunics worn under armour, and in years to come shapers and shepsters and cutters out. We know little about these people as they don't really appear in text records. Early 14th century taxpayers were, after all, freemen who owned goods worth the taxable minimum or above. And we estimate there may have been 2,000 or more heads of household who paid subsidies during this period. And there is no doubt that they represented only a small proportion of the working population of the London area, which most people estimate to be around about 40,000 people. Now, this working population of London does not include the clergy and others who served St. Paul's, the parish churches, and a vast number of other ecclesiastical or monastic establishments. It doesn't include the moneyers, it doesn't include the foreign merchants, and it doesn't include the staff of the households of the landlords and magnates of England who maintained a London house, and it doesn't include the lawyers and the royal and other officials. That's 40,000 workers except them. But out of that 40,000, only 2,000 or so made the taxpayer class. And it is from that basic qualification that alderman status was then elevated out of the richer of those 2,000. We also see people who do okay, but just don't make that threshold. Below the taxpayers, but above everybody else. The best example was when we saw a bunch of tradesmen, tailors, upholders, hosiers and skinners, who were summoned before the mayor back in the 1320s for selling their wares at evening fairs held on Cornhill at Cheapside. Now, a number of these people came from the poorer areas just outside the city wall, but what we ended up with was a list of 74 men and 16 women, mostly wives working with their husband, but a dozen of them could be traced as taxpayers previously. And what you see aren't so much people who are destitute selling on the street as their only outlet. These were kind of respectable people who just didn't have a shop. And they were able to appeal and support their right to do this to the king, and a royal writ back in 1323 ordered the mayor and aldermen to allow them sell their goods according to their ancient rights. And in that document, these people are named as mediocris populi, or people of the middle condition in the city. It itself an important and healthy reminder that many who were considered of middle status were still not liable for taxation, either because they were not freemen or because they didn't meet the tax threshold. Who were the mediocris populi? Well, we know there were 147 skinners listed in London's records during the 1330s. And that also included men known as toyers who dressed the skins. And perhaps more than two-thirds of the men working in the fur trade belonged in this middling category. Some were prosperous dealers who worked from their homes and sold in streets and markets. And some deliberately contrived to evade the responsibilities of citizenship so, you know, they could avoid the crippling taxes. Others formed a pool of both skilled and semi-skilled labour on which the merchants depended. Conditions for workers varied from handicraft to handicraft. But we actually see in the 1330s that the largest staff noted in any London records were 18 men maintained by a pewterer. We also know that over in the wards of Aldgate and Portsoken, the suburb which had grown up outside the wall and which stretched almost from Bishopsgate to the river and was effectively the first ever East End, there were plenty of opportunities for relatively unskilled work. Portsoken had only 43 taxpayers in 1319, five of which were potters, and by 1330s this had dropped down to 23, which included potters, a drover, some butchers, some brewers, and a couple of fruitiers. These numbers suggested a population with a high proportion of men who were either poor freemen or not freemen at all. Many of them probably had little more than labourer's status. Metal workers like the braziers, who ordinances implied that only one in four categories of men were employed by them were fully trained, no doubt drew heavily on these sources of labour. Portsoken's proximity to the Tower of London probably provided casual employment in this area as well, as the war with Scotland became war with France, and that brought increasing demands for supplies of all sorts. While a small permanent staff was constantly maintained at the Tower of London, which served as a depot for bows, arrows, timber, canvas and rope dispatched from differing parts of the country, there were numerous odd jobs to be done in the tower itself, such as making covers for crossbows, corselets for archers, quivers and boxes for carrying arrows and armour, and painting everything from ships to shields. London, then as now, was an engine of work and industry only without any safety net, and then as now, war generated business. The work to be found in and around the Tower of London was indicative that King Edward was now at war in France, and with that came big impacts on the city. We saw how difficult it was to be recruited to join the armed forces of London to go to war in Scotland. But given that, we read in 1338 that the city sent a large delegation to France to fight for the king. And the records indicate that beginning with the cavalry, quote, paid to the 40 men-at-arms for their wages and arms, 60 shillings. Paid to the 60 archers for their wages, bows and arrows and other necessities, 30 shillings. Paid to the men-at-arms and archers aforesaid, as a courtesy by order of the mayor and aldermen, 10 shillings. Paid to William Haterin, the centurion, and to William Masseries for their trouble in selecting the said 100 men, 40 shillings. For the purchase of 346 and a half ells of red and green cloth for gowns, £22, 19 shillings, 9 pence. For the buying of 70 ells of blankets for their hoods, £4, 7 shillings, 6 pence. For making such gowns and hoods, 100 shillings. Paid to Nicholas de Aberdoyne, sergeant, for escorting the said man out to our lord the king, 4 marks. For the buying of a standard, flag and trumpet, and for the carriage of arms, 11 shillings, unquote. So just sending 100 men involved all of this, and the Londoners marched off in their absolutely fantastic red and green uniforms with hoods for the grand cost of, quote, £137, 11 shillings and 7 pence, unquote. That was just for 100 men. War was expensive. But war was present on the streets even with all the fighting happening in France. Records in the 1330s of London say that a specific fortified house had been constructed to store heavy weapons. The house was called La Bretasque, and it was built, quote, near the Tower of London, unquote. And inside it, it was known to contain, quote, 7 springalls and 380 quarrels for the same feathered with latone, unquote. So springalls were giant crossbows, ferocious battle machines with square-headed ammunition feathered with brass ends. But these were not the only heavy weapons in London, because there now follows in the Chronicles of London one of the most significant records in British military history. Because the records say that in 1339, hidden in London, quote, in the chamber of the Guildhall, there are 6 instruments of latone, usually called guns, and 5 rolleries to the same. Also pellets of lead for the same instruments, which weigh 400 weight and a half. Also 32 pounds of powder for the said instruments, unquote. For the first time in English history, we have a record of cannon. From those words, we know they were made from latone, which, as we said, was a metal resembling brass. We see that they were fixed, but could be moved on rollaries or rollers, and that they fired pellets or balls, usually made of lead. Worth noting, the original document described them using the word vocitata, which translates as usually called. So when they say these weapons were usually called guns, it meant that by 1339 they were well known. Who made them? Well, we do not know. It is suspected they'd been made over in Italy and were probably imported by somebody like the Bardi. Cannons had been used in defending Florence back in 1326, so this was a new innovation, and London had some. Here in the 14th century, London had 6 cannons hidden in the Guildhall of the Mayor. But war has more tangible realities. The King sent a letter to the Mayor in this decade, warning them, quote, "For so much as our enemies collected in galleys, in no small multitude, have in hostile manner entered our kingdom in diverse parts, and propose shortly to invade our city, if they can," unquote. These invasion fears were very real. The French were coming, quote, "there to perpetuate such evil and wickedness as they may," unquote. What was London to do? Well, that's what the King was writing to him about. His instructions, quote, "We, desiring to provide for the safety and defence of the city aforesaid against such hostile attacks, do command you that with all the speed that you may, you cause the city to be closed and fortified against such hostile attacks towards the water, with stone and with board, and that you cause piles to be driven across the water of the Thames for the defence of the city," unquote. Here was a King of England evoking the ancient ghosts of London to defend the river from foreign invaders. Quote, "And all men who hold rents in the city aforesaid, as well as religious as others, of whatever estate they be, you are to compel to make such defence, by distress, or any other such means, as you deem most expedient, sparing no one in this behalf," unquote. This was a full alert upon the city. Everyone was to be involved. There were to be no shirkers from helping. Hints of the London sin, the feared of Æthelred's London, are being rekindled here. The city had withstood the likes of Heaston and Forkbeard and Commute. And here we are hundreds of years later in the 1330s, and that spirit is being evoked against the French. So when we picture London in the 1330s, keep in mind that they're building river defences. And we wonder, were those 6 cannons being stored in the Lord Mayor's Guildhall in an effort to facilitate defence against the French? We'll never know for sure. And what effect would have this had on the citizens? Well, we know for one thing, it didn't stop any crime. The people of London in the 1330s still had criminals, and crime was always prevalent in this crazy and busy city. But from some of the stories of crime, we gain insights into the stories of the people behind it. We have the likes of John Le White, a skinner by day and burglar by night. John broke into a store of a mercer called Geoffrey Bunt, clearing him out of, quote, "rings of gold and silver, pearls, linen thread, bracelets, tablets, and other goods and chattels of his, to the value of 100 shillings, feloniously stolen at night from the shop of the same Geoffrey at the corner of the lane of St. Lawrence Jewry towards Cheap," unquote. John was found with the goods on him and was prosecuted and hung. But it isn't just male thieves. We have the story of Desiderata de Toyntone. This female thief robbed a traveller called John Barrett, who'd come down from Berkshire and who was staying in a hostel on Fleet Street. Barrett worked for a rich woman called Lady Alice de Liesel and was carrying to London a range of expensive items, including, quote, 30 dishes and 24 salt cellars of silver, value £40, unquote. When he stayed at the hostelry, Desiderata helped herself, and later, when she was captured, quote, 14 dishes and 12 salt cellars were found upon her, unquote. And you have opportunist thieves like the local-born Walter, son of John Barry, who was accused by the tailor Robert de Baconworth of stealing an expensive surcoat, quote, of apple bloom, unquote, or apple blossom, which was apparently a very popular shade this decade, and also an expensive blanket from the tailor's house. But sometimes a crime reveals a lot more about the people involved, both the victim and the criminal. And the best example of this is the murder of Alice Le Beverey. Alice was killed by her husband, and the details and reasons for this act of horrendous domestic violence I won't go into, but we know that her husband Hugh was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death for his crime. Yet in the records of the case is a small glimpse of their lives together. Since both husband and wife were dead and no children were named, their estate was seized and the city authorities meticulously pored through all the items in their possession. And here we see in this inventory the realities of a couple living in this era, neatly laid out, their possessions, the clothes they wore, the things they used, the things they valued. There's a tragic poignancy here. We get an insight into the reality of their lives, laid out meticulously and carefully by the state, with the values of all items added. Quote, one mattress, value 4 shillings, 6 blankets and 1 serge, 13 shillings and sixpence, 1 green carpet, 2 shillings, 1 torn coverlet with shields of sennade, 4 shillings, 1 coat and 1 surcoat of worsted, 40 pence, 1 robe of purset, furred, 20 shillings, 1 robe of medley, furred, 1 mark, 1 old fur, almost consumed by moths, 6 pence, 1 robe of scarlet, furred, 16 shilling. 1 robe of purset, 7 shilling. 1 surcoat with a striped hood, 2 shillings and sixpence. 1 coat with a hood of purset, 18 shillings. 1 surcoat and 1 coat of ray, 6 shillings 1 pence. 1 green hood of fendal with an edging, 6 pence. 7 linen sheets, 1 tablecloth, 1 chemise and 1 apron, 1 canvas, 3 feather beds, 5 cushions, 3 brass pots. 1 brass pot broken, 1 candlestick of latone and 1 plate, 2 pieces of lead, 1 grate, 2 basins with 1 washing vessel, 1 iron hearse, 1 tripod, 1 iron headpiece, 1 iron spit, 1 frying pan, 1 funnel, 1 small canvas bag, 1 old linen sheet, 2 pillows, 2 coffers, 2 curtains, 2 remnants of cloth, 6 chests, 1 folding table, 2 chairs, 1 portable cupboard, 2 tubs, unquote. That's not the full list, but you have an insight. A rich couple, their lives before us, before the husband killed the wife, and then was killed for his own sins. Their worldly goods today would be worth, in today's money, £7,922.07. Although, realistically, as antiques, they'd be worth a heck of a lot more. When looking at the normal people in the city in the 1330s, we see that they, like us today, had issues with infrastructure. Theirs, however, could just be a tad more fundamental. Take, for example, the moment when, quote, John de Enfield, Thomas de Kevesini, and other neighbours dwelling around the conduit in London, and for the commonalty, showed to the mayor, sheriffs and aldermen that the same commonalty of the city cannot be served with water from the said conduit, as it used to be served. Because the men that kept brew houses in the streets and lanes near the said conduit sent day after day and night after night their brewers to said conduit with their vessels called tines, unquote. Tines were these very large tubs. And what was happening with the brewers around the conduit were turning up to collect up the water in them, which they used to, quote, make the ale, which they sell with the water thereof, and also, in a like matter, they make malt with the same water, unquote. This massive use of water on Cheapside was done, quote, to the loss of the commonality, unquote. In other words, the down brewers were leaving the normal residents without enough water to use themselves. Simply put, the residents of Cheapside, quote, ask that this common damage may be corrected, that the same conduit may from henceforth be kept for the public good, as of old it used to be kept, unquote. Inquiry was ordered, and the order was made about the tines, quote, that in future any such vessels of those aforesaid should by chance be brought to be filled in the conduit, they should not allow it to be taken away, but retain it for their own possession on behalf of the said conduit, unquote. So the mayor towards the latter stages of this decade was a man called Henry D'Arcy, and he was in time replaced, after 2 terms in office, by a new mayor called Andrew Aubrey. But the day Aubrey became mayor, quote, hardly had the oath of said Andrew been finished, according to the custom of the city, when there came one Gerald Corp, full of wrath, into the presence of said mayor, alderman, and the whole commonality, and then mounted the counter of which the clerks of the city sat, and uttered words of contumely against the said Henry Darcy, threatening him and imputing to him that when he was mayor he had called him, Gerald, a malefactor and a common rifler, unquote. So, picture the scene. New mayor is sworn in. The old mayor and the great and the good are watching. It's a big ceremony. And in comes this Gerald Cope, a pepperer, who's now stood on a table, and he's saying the former mayor had besmirched his character, and he called him a thief. Possibly Cope was doing this because he hoped that the new mayor, who was a fellow pepperer, would turn a deaf ear to the threats he was issuing. But Aubrey was something of a law and order type mayor, and responded, perhaps in a way Gerald did not expect. So Gerald was getting into a proper froth now. Quote, and the same Gerald there, with divers oath affirmed, that no words had been uttered in the city for the past 20 years, last passed at a dealer rate, that would prove to have been by reason of his revenge. And upon this, the same Gerald asserted that he was ready to produce 20 men of his acquaintance and condition in life to testify that he, Gerald, had not been a rifler. Unquote. How did our new mayor respond to this? Quote, which words, threats and reproofs being heard by the mayor, alderman and the commonality, and by Roger de Defham, the recorder, being immediately repeated by order of the said mayor, the said Gerald was delivered to the sheriffs in the prison of Newgate, at their discretion safely to be kept, unquote. Yep, they arrested him and jailed him. Was Gerald being silenced for whistleblowing? Was Henry Darcy pulling strings and having a man he disliked finally jailed? Or was the man on the table drunk and giving it large? We'll never know, but we do go on to read that, quote, afterwards, Andrew Aubrey, the mayor, Henry Darcy, another alderman, came to the aforesaid Gerald, unquote, and the rather shamefaced man, quote, acknowledged that he had spoken slanderously and had undeservedly censured the said Henry, the late mayor, in a manner aforesaid, asking pardon of him in the same. And he put himself first upon the favour of him, the same Henry, and after that on the favour of the mayor. And he bound himself and all his goods, movable and immovable, in 40 tons of wine, unquote. Yeah, he said, that was uncalled for, I'm really sorry, and he paid a fine. Now, the interesting thing is, he paid the fine to keep the peace in wine, 40 tons of wine, and not money. And that was probably because at this exact moment in time, the King's Wars in France were so expensive and costly, London was facing another economic crisis, and there was another shortage of coins to be had. Anyway, that story ends with, quote, and the same Gerald made an oath that to the best of his power, he would inviolably keep the peace of our Lord the King, and would well and peaceably behave and conduct himself, unquote. Yeah, Gerald failed, by the way. Gerald Cope, his fellow pepperer brother Thomas Cope, and Thomas's servant, would in only a few years' time attack and imprison an Italian merchant, but that's in the future. Around now, these economic crises were making some interesting things happen. Interesting things? Well, take, for example, Gerald Cope's brother Thomas Cope, who was trying to raise money to invest in the king's new wool scheme, and he was accused in 1337 by a man who claimed to be an alchemist and said that Thomas had seized him by force and imprisoned him in his house with his elixir and instruments and forced him to teach him the art of making silver plates. We suspect this wild accusation was a cover for the fact that the alchemist owed Thomas Cope £200 and the pepperer had resorted to forced to recover the money. We know that rich men like Walter Adrian took the more customary course of selling their family silver to raise cash. Cups, bucklers and girdles were sacrificed along with linen sheets, a tablecloth, prayer beads, and what must have been a treasured family possession, a cup-bearing impression of Thomas of Lancaster, a remainder of better fortunes under the Lord's ordainers. Meanwhile, our spicer on Cheapside called William de Doughton in 1338 was accused of keeping a house of ill fame to which married women and the paramours resorted. For the women involved, prostitution probably could have been the only alternative to sudden destitution, and the spicer paid for his enterprise with 2 months in Newgate. As had happened in the similar financial crisis of 1298 to 1301, the sudden lack of coins and consequent growth of unemployment meant a return of unrest and disorder in London. We have foreign sailors being assaulted in 1337. The term of the new mayor, Andrew Aubrey, then, was going to be interesting. Mayor Aubrey was the son of Roger and Denise Aubrey. He had been a pepperer and was the first pepperer since Thomas Romaine to hold the post. The 1330s had seen him rise in the political community of the city. He was elected one of the sheriffs of London back in 31 and become the alderman for Bedward Street in 33, and he held that till 1345 when he went to serve on as alderman of Cornwainer Ward for a decade. He was to be elected mayor in 1338, going into 1339, and then on. He was also elected a member of parliament for the city in the parliaments of 1338 and 1340. And he inherited an unstable city. And part of this instability was caused by the king himself. In 1339, quote, "Sir Robert de Ashbury, clerk of the Lord the King, came to the Guildhall of London, and on the king's behalf brought word to the mayor that he and all the aldermen in the city, together with the wealthiest and most discreet persons of the same city, were to appear before our lord the king and his council at Westminster on the Thursday following, upon certain arduous business touching upon the estate of the same our lord the king and of the whole realm of England," unquote. So, as summoned that Thursday, quote, "the mayor and the aldermen and the great number of the commonalty of the city appeared before our said lord the king and his council at Westminster. And the king then orally made mention of the expenses incurred by him in his war in the parts beyond the seas, and still to be incurred therein. And he requested them lend him £20,000 sterling for the business aforesaid. And the said mayor, aldermen and commonalty asked leave to discuss the same, whereupon they were told to be there on the Friday following, then to make answer as to matters aforesaid," unquote. £20,000. Holy shit. And they had to give him an answer by the next day? Quote, "upon which day the said mayor and alderman and a great number of the commonalty in the city were assembled in the chapter house at Westminster, and there holding counsel amongst themselves as to the said £20,000, they unanimously agreed to lend him 5,000 marks, which some they said they could not exceed," unquote. So yeah, instead of £20,000, it's only 5,000 marks of silver. The mayor went back and Aubrey discovered, quote, "whereupon our lord the king altogether rejected it and commanded the mayor, aldermen and commonalty, upon the fealty and allegiance in which they were bound to him, to take better counsel as to the matters aforesaid, or else bring the names of all the wealthier citizens in writing before the king and his council at Westminster on the Sunday following, so that he and his council might assess such wealthier men of the city as to the said sum of £20,000, unquote. This was rapidly becoming a crisis. The king's demand was extraordinary, but London's offer had been derisory. Quote, "upon which Sunday, a little after sunrise, there were assembled in the Guildhall of London Andrew de Aubrey, the mayor, John de Grantham, Henry Darcy, and 14 other aldermen, and an immense number of the wealthier and more reputable men of the city. And after divers reasons of several persons had been set forth and listened to with due circumspection, in order to avoid the indignation of our lord the king and other perils, by unanimous consent, although it was a hard thing and difficult to do, they agreed to lend £5,000 to our lord the king for the matter before them," unquote. You can imagine how intense those negotiations would have been, and all credit to Andrew Aubrey for pulling it off. And him and a small delegation went to deliver this news in person. And this time the, quote, "offer the king accepted, and he commended his said citizens in friendly manner," unquote. Well, whew. Okay, that was agreed upon. Now came the hard part, raising the cash. Quote, "and on the same Sunday, by assent of said mayor, alderman and the commonalty, 12 persons were chosen and sworn to assess all men in the city aforesaid and in the suburbs thereof, every one according to the requirement of his condition, for levying the said sum of £5,000. They sparing no one for favour or for love, nor yet injuring any person for hatred and dislike," unquote. The mood caused by this new tax in London was fractious. As the king left to return back to his war in France, the city had to gather up a lot of money, and the taxpayers of the city were not very happy about this. And in return, these taxpayers influenced the men who were loyal to them. And very quickly, the city became a powder keg. Again. And over the next few days and weeks, the tensions rose. The city's sergeants were already facing defiance when they attempted to collect the monies. The constable and the sergeant of Castle Baynard Wood were set upon, and the beadle of Aldgate Ward was threatened. The fishmongers, who were always ready to kick off at a moment's notice, then got into a fight with a bunch of skinners. We don't know why, but we do know that the skinners started it. However, the fight got vicious, and one of the fishmongers was arrested. At this, a large body of angry fishmongers, armed with knives, went to release their member who had been arrested, and in Bridge Street they confronted the mayor and his sheriffs. This rescue attempt caused a huge battle on the streets of London, as several fishmongers decided to express their displeasure with the authorities. One man, Thomas Horsand, the son of one of the city's leading fishmongers, John Horsand, pulled a sword or large knife, grabbed the mayor by the throat and tried to cut his throat. Another of the mob, a porter called John Le Brewery, stabbed one of the mayor's sergeants with a knife and left him so badly injured, many thought he'd die from his injuries. And yet the authorities claimed the day, and the result of the Battle of Bridge Street was that John Le Brewery and Thomas Horsand were arrested. But the tense situation carried on. As always, if the mayor could not restore and maintain law and order upon London, then Edward III would have every reason to suspend the mayoralty and take over the city's government. But what to do about these two arseholes? Only the severest measures, it was felt, would shock the angry taxpayers, rival livery gangs and disorderly unemployed youths into obedience and submission. Yet the young man who had publicly assaulted the mayor and so flagrantly challenged the whole edifice of the city's government was the son of a leading merchant and ship owner and a leading member of the fractious Fishmongers Livery Company, whose elements had repeatedly terrorized the streets with their deadly knives. If Thomas Horsand paid a severe price for his misdeeds, would the other fishmongers find allies amongst the other discontented and cause the city to be consumed by civil strife? Mayor Aubrey had to act swiftly. The next day, inquests were arranged about the affray, and the mayor summoned representatives of all the wards to a meeting with the aldermen and sheriffs. The two men accused of assaulting the mayor and of wounding his sergeant were brought before the assembly, and they acknowledged their guilt in the hope, no doubt, that their sentences would be lightened. The city's authorities had no power to inflict capital punishment on anybody, except in a case of thieves who were caught red-handed. Only the king's justices could condemn them to death in normal times. But with the king being overseas, and the mayor responsible for keeping the city safe for him, and a long delay waiting for itinerant royal justice to hear the case, this all meant there could be a continuation of the disorder. For a month, Aubrey waited, perhaps hoping for some writ from the king or some word that he should proceed. None came. But he used the interval to consult and mould opinion. On the 31st of August, he summoned a huge assembly of 528 men of London elected by the different wards. They were asked what punishment should be meted out to the guilty pair for attacking the city authorities. The answer was immediate. The two men should be dragged to the stone cross in Cheapside. And there they were to be beheaded. The sentence was carried out the same day. Aubrey's masterful combination of action and delay, of authoritative leadership and just the right amount of consultation, solved the crisis which threatened to bring the city into turmoil. The names of all those who were sentenced to the death sentence were inscribed in the city's records as a precaution against backsliding and also to protect the mayor. But there was no civil disturbance. Only the grieving mother of Thomas was called on the following year with other women to give security for their behaviour. The skinner, who is said to be the instigator of this entire thing, was let off lightly with a year's punishment. The lesson to Londoners was clear. The authority of this mayor was to be sacrosanct. It was to be all that stood between them and anarchy. And this was acknowledged by the king. He sent a letter, after he heard about all of this, directly to the mayor. Obviously, Mayor Aubrey was worried that the king would be upset, that him and the city had just beheaded two people without the king's say-so. However, when the king in France heard of this, the letter ended with the words, quote, We do greatly congratulate you, unquote. Mayor Aubrey was vindicated and became an icon of stability in a fractious city. He had faced down the mob and he had won. As such, it should come as no surprise that in 1440 he was re-elected to serve a much quieter second term. Aubrey's leadership in this crisis won him the respect of the citizens. And he was to be re-elected mayor again 10 years later when another crisis in the city's history came up. London in the 1330s then was a place of life, vibrancy, passion and of extreme violence. Same as it ever was, really. And I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And I'll be back next week for the 120th chapter of The Story of London. Cheers.